This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Last week, Mayor Pedro Segarra used our program as a vehicle to give us an alternate version of a story of state support for the Hartford minor league baseball team. It kicked off a pretty nasty week of tit-for-tat between the Molloy administration and the mayor who is running to keep his job. Meanwhile, a hiker's interaction with the Black Bear went viral and kicked off a battle between a Spare the Bear faction, there's a hashtag in front of that, and another group who think that this repeat offender needs to be put down. Today in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, we will consider these stories and talk through the single funniest email in Hillary Clinton's pile of emails. You can join the conversation at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment at our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello once again, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Mark Pazniokas is here. He is Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hello, Paz.
Happy September.
Yes, I know it is September. It feels strange to say. Daniela Altomare is State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Hello, Daniela.
Hi.
So first of all, we're going to start with Richard Blumenthal. President Obama is close to having the number of votes he needs to pass the Iran nuclear deal after Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey announced his support for the measure. One lawmaker who has not announced his position is our own Senator Richard Blumenthal. In fact, he's the only member of Connecticut's congressional delegation who has not announced a decision. All the other members will be supporting the deal. Colin, you had the senator on your program this Monday. Why did he say he's taking so long to make the decision?
Well, John, he's studying it.
Is that what's happening?
He's joined a study group. They meet in the evenings. No, I mean, he is taking the position that he is not only reading the 158-page agreement or however long it is, but he's reading a lot of ancillary materials and very, very studiously weighing the pros and cons. I mean, I would have to say that this is not all that persuasive. That in many ways, I mean, really what's happening now, which is, I think, you know, not a good thing for him really, is that the other pieces are falling into place. We're now one vote away from what it would take to override a veto or to prevent a veto override, excuse me. There's a Republican resolution that basically works against the deal. So they need one more senator. It's probably not going to be Blumenthal based on what he said to me. He's not that close to making a decision. And this Hamlet Act, I mean, it does a whole bunch of different things, including, you know, this is a guy who basically has a pretty safe seat. I know we're going to be talking about that. But compared to, say, a guy like Joe Donnelly out in Indiana who's already come out in favor of this deal, he's got a pretty safe seat, and it is something that's rather infuriating to his colleagues that he can't make up his mind about this. And even talking to him, I have to say, I mean, to me, once you strip away everything else, one of the really important parts of this is that the other five major nations are going to go forward with this, so that if we step out of the deal, all we do is really make ourselves irrelevant.
There's essentially no going back for the U.S. at this point.
No. I mean, he's actually suggested in one of his things that sometimes you can get a better deal or something. No, that's not happening. That's just not on this planet happening. So, I mean, I'm astonished that it's taking him this long. And I think, you know, I mean, you hate to make an uncharitable assumption, but it seems as though that this is one of these Hamlet acts where he's kind of counting noses, figuring out. This is something, by the way, that one of his predecessors, Joe Lieberman, was very good at. Counting noses, figuring out where his vote will matter the most, or whether he can make a vote that's politically maybe a little bit more appealing to him without damaging the substance of something else. Although there's another magic number down the line, and that's the number of senators it takes to sustain a filibuster on this. Ideally, what you'd like to not have happen, if you believe in the Iran deal, you'd like to not have this resolution go to President Obama, have the president veto it, and then just have the vote count on override. That's not, for the sake of the nation, a very appealing spectacle. Not that a filibuster is that much more appealing, but it's a little bit more appealing. So that would require getting to 41, at which point Blumenthal's vote comes back into play.
Paz?
Yeah, domestic politics are looming large in this. Let's be honest. The danger for Blumenthal, as Colin really suggested, is when you stand in the spotlight for a protracted period of time on an issue like this, the danger is you may be stuck in the spotlight when the story turns and it really becomes a very hot, uncomfortable place to stand. And that seems to be one of the risks. You know, it's always hard to game out what Senator Blumenthal is thinking. I mean, he is, by most conventional standards, bulletproof. But then again, you know, so is Chuck Schumer. Now, Chuck Schumer has a, you know, strong Jewish population. There's a division in the Jewish population in New York. But, you know, Schumer, who's presumed to be the next Senate Democratic leader, if he's going to go his own way, I think it's going to be a little bit hard for the Jewish senator in the next state to be taking some time to play with it as well.
And there's actually been some of this in the press, though, too, which is interesting, is asking a lot of these questions, Paz, about who are the key senators who are Jewish and what that might have to do with anything. And at the end of the day, this Iran deal having anything to do with whether or not that is your heritage seems to be a little bit far-fetched. It certainly is something that may have to do with what sort of support you get back home. But at the end of the day, I can't see how that has anything to do with it.
It's a lazy yardstick. But, you know, at times it's not irrelevant. You know, you look at, you know, it's not just religion. I mean, you can look at support for Israel. It comes from many places for many reasons. You know, conservatives have their own rationale. Fundamental Christians have their own rationale. So, I mean, it does get very complicated.
What does all this sort of mean for Blumenthal and how he's viewed back home, Daniela? I mean, while this is going on, Colin had him on the show today. He's kind of still hemming and hawing about what he's going to do on the Iran nuclear deal, which is essentially the biggest issue facing Congress, specifically the Senate right now. Meanwhile, just in this last week or couple weeks, here are the sorts of emails we're getting from Blumenthal's office. One having to do with the retail sale of powdered caffeine. One has to do about technologies to protect airplane pilots against lasers. One has to do with the role of women on currency. He talked with a bunch of Girl Scouts about that. He talked about e-cigarettes, about drones, about car airbags. Not unworthy things, certainly, but you covered him for a long time when he was Attorney General of the state of Connecticut, and it seems as though as he runs for re-election now with so many other things going on in the world, a lot of what he does want to focus on are some of those, you know, retail issues we used to hear a lot about in Hartford.
Yeah, people have called him Senator Smallball. You know, he's
not heard that. I like that.
He's made a I apologize. I can't. It was, I think, a conservative columnist who called him that, and I can't cite the source, so it was not my my description. But yep. It's perhaps an apt one. You know, he's sort of made this animal rights issue. Sort of, he's taken on a lot of animal causes lately after the Cecil the Lion thing. Maybe he'll weigh in on the bear discussion.
Probably bring him in on the bear discussion a little bit later.
I mean, first of all, he's responsible for all those system administrator things that you get. This is your mailbox is over its size limit. I blame him when that happens to me because you know all of us have waiting with big capital letters in the subject line a bear email is waiting for us.
Well, look, so there's that piece of it. So he's waiting on the Iran deal. This is happening. Meanwhile, I'll just say, you know, Senator Chris Murphy, the junior senator here, junior in a lot of different ways, here's somebody who's taken a lead on a lot of foreign policy issues. He's heading over to the Middle East right now. Once again, he's taken the lead on issues like Ukraine because he's stepped into a void of senators who really didn't seem to care much about Europe, and then all of a sudden Europe became somewhat important. I don't know, Colin, if it means anything for his 2016 reelection campaign, but in many ways Richard Blumenthal and the gravitas that one might have by being senator is somewhat in the shadow of his junior colleague who seems to be swinging pretty big as opposed to playing small ball.
Well, you just made Chris Murphy's day, first of all. But I think the key word you used was lead. You know, I mean, you're supposed to lead, right? And particularly when you have a safe seat, you're supposed to lead. Now, that has not always been the history of Connecticut senators. The history is that they typically, unless their name is Lowell Weicker, have very safe seats. They don't always take advantage of that. You could say that Lieberman took advantage of it by concocting a lot of fairly unappetizing policies about Iraq. But for the most part, Lieberman was very cagey about what he did. And I mean, Chris Dodd didn't feel as though he could vote against going into Iraq. I mean, how safe does his seat have to be? John Larson seemed to understand that he could oppose invading Iraq. And I really do. I get very frustrated when people who are so politically safe are still so politically cautious that they can't speak their mind. I care less. I mean, I would like to Dick Blumenthal to approve this deal, but I care less which thing he does. But I think he should have done it a long time ago.
But do you feel he's really truly conflicted, or do you think he's just?
I don't think he's conflicted.
So
I think
so he knows he's made up his mind. He knows what he's going to do, and he just.
I mean, I'm not the mentalist, but I feel like I do know this.
Well, so that notwithstanding, we will say we've heard from our old friend Ned Lamont, who, of course, ran against Joe Lieberman over the Iraq War. He's basically urging Blumenthal to say yes to the Iran deal, in part because I think Ned and a lot of other businessmen see business opportunities in Themdar Hills out in Tehran, right, Paz?
There is that. By the way, I did talk to some of Lamont's old friends, and I am assured that they foresee no challenge from the left to Senator Blumenthal in 2016. So just to set your mind at ease on that point.
Okay. Well, speaking of challenges, let's actually listen to a little bit of Colin's program where we did get a little unguarded moment from Richard Blumenthal. Let's listen a little bit here.
Well, you know, U.S. Senator Dick Blumenthal, you know that I like you. I'm personally fond of you. And I know that you put the interest of the people of Connecticut and the people of the United States first and not your own. So it's my job sometimes to tell you why it's in your own best interest to vote to approve this deal. Now, we found out over the weekend that Lawrence Kudlow, who is a gibbering idiot, has said that he is going to run against you if you vote to approve this deal. So that's why you should vote to approve this deal. I mean, you get Lawrence Kudlow as a possible future opponent in your next election. It's a guaranteed victory. Have you thought about that?
I think this is an appropriate place for me to say no comment.
The thing I like about that is he really says no comment, Colin, but you got him to say no comment on something.
Right. And that sort of, you know, it sounds like Mr. Burns laughing, you know, there's like a kind of dusty, unused quality to his laugh, but he did laugh.
I want to make the point that Colin just really did a left version of a Colbert moment.
Yeah.
The way he carried that off.
Yeah. It was nice, wasn't it? I thought it was
beautiful.
Well, and look, and not everyone knows the person that Colin was talking about. Larry Kudlow is a CNBC pundit. He's a conservative. He's basically said, Paz, that if Dick Blumenthal votes for this Iran deal, he's going to challenge. He lives in Redding, Connecticut. He's going to be the challenger. I mean, should Dick Blumenthal be shaking in his boots?
No.
Next.
Kudlow, you know, he has homes in New York and Connecticut, and he is part of that celebrity class when Republicans in this part of the world can't find a candidate, they ask him to consider it. You know, the same – similar with the outreach to Joe Scarborough, which, by the way, I would put in a different category. As a former member of Congress who knows how to talk to the vast majority of Americans, I think that's another matter. But Kudlow, no. I mean, Kudlow – you know, he rants, he raves. He does go to the Prescott Bush dinner, the big Republican fundraiser many years. I saw him there this year. Kudlow's got a great, great personal bio, by the way. I mean, and he's written very honestly about it, you know, flings with cocaine and the whole bit. That would be a fun, fun race. So I'm with Colin. I mean, you know, Senator Blumenthal, please provoke Larry Kudlow into jumping
in. Well, it would be a lot of fun for us to cover, certainly, Danielle. I mean, right now, Richard Blumenthal, we hadn't even really thought about him being up for re-election, right? Because it's such a safe seat. 2016 is supposed to be all about the presidential race. And the only Tucker had to look this up once again. I'd forgotten that the man who is running against Richard Blumenthal right now is a guy named August Wolf.
Yeah, and one of our colleagues at the Capitol in the press room, Sue Hager, wrote a great profile of him that ran yesterday. He's an interesting guy, but does he have the wherewithal to topple Blumenthal? Probably
Augie.
Not.
He's actually was known as Augie as an athlete, I think.
Was he known as Augie?
Yes, but we have to guard against, because every time I say Augie, I have referred to him happily, not in print or on radio or anywhere else, as Augie Bush, but I've said it in the press room a number of times.
Well, I have to say, apropos of the Sue Haig profile, I mean, I tweeted about this earlier this week, but I mean, I just love the final paragraph. So he was an Olympic athlete. And he's talking about sort of the distance he has to cover to catch up with a juggernaut like Dick Blumenthal. And he says, my first meet at Princeton, I threw 43 feet. To make the Olympic team, I had to throw it 68, 69 feet. Okay? He says, imagine. Okay? That's like, huh? I'm going to do the same in this election. So first of all, there's nothing like a Princeton shot put analogy. It's like we can all identify with that, right? I mean, like, we've all been there in some way. So just in terms of connecting with the voters, smart move, Augie.
He was also suspended from international competition for a period over a question of him declining to take a test.
Right. He declined a drug test in Norway. But everybody does that. I've declined drug tests in Norway, too. I mean, it's just that's the smart play.
And I routinely,
you don't know what's in that fish you eat over there.
I routinely refuse them upon leaving here on Wednesdays.
Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Mark Bazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Daniela Altomare, State House Reporter for the Hartford Current. When we come back, we're going to talk about what happens when a mayor kicks a porcupine. It's not always pretty. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Joining us today in The Wheelhouse is Daniela Altomare. She is State House Reporter for the Hartford Current. Mark Pazniokas is Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. And our own Colin McEnroe hosts The Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR, which you can hear at 1 o'clock each weekday. Colin, what's on the show today?
We'll be looking back on the legacy and exciting world of Hunter S. Thompson. Actually, a novelist from Connecticut has written a novel based on her time as kind of an intern to Hunter S. Thompson. You can just use your imagination for what that was like.
A book called Gonzo Girl. It's right. Coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
She probably would have flunked a number of Norwegian drug tests just by contact ties.
That's coming up at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show today. So last week, Hartford Mayor Pedro Segarra was on our program. We're going to be talking with Luke Bronin, who's running against him for his seat in about a week or so. Now, Segarra is running for re-election with the primary 2 weeks from today. He had mentioned approaching the governor before a deal for a minor league baseball team was announced. This was all new to us. It's one of the many things that came out during that interview that seemed a little bit new. So let's listen to a little bit from last week's Where We Live with Pedro Segarra.
During that period of time, I don't know, just around that period of time, it was presented in terms of this is what we want to do. We would like to get some state support.
Okay. See, what I had heard from the state was that they hadn't been approached at all by the city of Hartford.
There was an election going on at that time.
Okay. And so what essentially Pedro Segarra seems to be saying to me, Mark Pazniokas, is that, first of all, what the governor and the mayor had said previously to us, that the state really hadn't been asked for any support for this move from New Britain to Hartford for a minor league baseball team, that essentially wasn't true, that the state had been approached by Mayor Segarra and actually even asked for money. So that's the first time I'd really heard that. And that kicked off this whole kind of series of back and forth from the governor's office, from the mayor's office. And it wasn't the only time during that hour that, to use a metaphor, it seemed as though the mayor was throwing the governor under the bus. I mean, what's it been like this week?
You know, there's been this kind of passive-aggressive undertone to this race regarding the relationship between Governor Malloy and Mayor Segarra. The governor is officially neutral, you know, unlike in Bridgeport, where he looked at the prospect of Joe Ganim coming back and he said, no, I'm going to endorse Bill
Finch.
That's
a fairly easy one.
That seemed to be a fairly easy one. But of course, Luke Bronin is somebody close to the governor. He was the governor's general counsel. He's known him for a number of years. The governor did a fairly provocative thing by showing up at a community meeting that Luke Bronin arranged on community violence. And now the governor didn't speak, but it was, you know, he was certainly showing the flag. And after that, it seemed things seemed to get a little grittier between City Hall and the governor's office. During the debate that Fox and The Current did, the mayor started throwing these darts, blaming the state for any number of the city's ills, you know, which is a risky thing given that Hartford, like every other large city in the state with the exception of Stamford, is to a varying degree a dependent of state government. Let's be honest about that.
Yeah. And Daniela, it started – we talked about the ballpark, but again – pilot funding, payment in lieu of taxes funding, whether or not there was enough money coming to the cities for public safety. It just seemed as though there was this litany of things that the mayor was pushing off on the state and saying, hey, look, we need help and we're not getting help from there. And the guy who's running against me was in the office during the Malloy administration and wasn't helping us either.
But it's just one more thing for Segarra. You know, everything's fair game in this race. It's so ugly and so intense. I mean, you have Luke Bronin's wife has become an issue. You have where his children go to school has become an issue. I'm not saying they shouldn't be, but these are all things that, you know, the Segarra campaign is just throwing out there. So why not, you know, throw Malloy into it as well? I mean, it's just, you know, there looks like they're going for this sort of, you know, kitchen sink, you know, idea.
Well, and that may well be the case, and it may well be that Pedro Segarra is running from behind Colin. But one of the things I thought afterward when Pedro Segarra had talked to me quite a bit about Dan Malloy and what he hadn't done for the city of Hartford is I thought, have you ever met Dan Malloy? Do you know him personally? Because if you do, you probably know that criticizing him on a radio show, criticizing him in debates, probably isn't going to help you get money or any sort of favor from the state in the future.
Well, first of all, just to go back to the clip that we played a few minutes ago, I really do recommend that people watch that interview and that moment on CTN. I recommend that people watch everything on CTN, especially OJK and After Dark. That's my favorite news show. But so what happens is there's this incredible silence, and then John Dankosky, sort of looking like Seiji Ozawa when like an oboe player has slept past his cue, is sort of flinging his hands. This is where you play. And there's this huge silence. And I wondered if Mayor Segarra suddenly realized what he had said. Because, I mean, there's two problems here. One of them has now been pretty well outlined, which is that he has antagonized the Porcupine. But the other one is that he himself said there had been no contact with the state. In other words, he consistently and unambiguously, when this whole thing was rolled out last year, said he hadn't gone to the state. He hadn't asked for anything from the state. I mean, that was his position, too. So not only is he making Malloy look like a liar, he's making himself look like a liar.
Which is taking somebody and rolling under the bus with him is an unusual move.
Yeah. And to take all this at face value, there's really no mystery why a Democratic administration on the eve of an election campaign would have shied away from opening the checkbook, giving Hartford a ton of money to build a stadium that's going to kill a stadium in New Britain, which, by the way, the state largely paid for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so it just seemed odd. I mean, but Segarra, I think, with a series of baby steps and a couple of big ones, has now committed himself to, okay, I'm running against Luke Bronin. I'm running against the man. I'm running against Dan Malloy. And I don't know whether there's some grand strategy to try to set himself up as saying, hey, you know, all the big boys are against me. Or whether he just stumbled into it, you know, I don't know.
It's also worth quickly noting that today, Erin Stewart announced that she's got a team, an Atlantic League team that's going to come into the New Britain Stadium. Which kind of, first of all, I guarantee you that Erin Stewart said to the Atlanta League, "Give me something before September 16th. I want to be able to say before that idiot goes into his primary, that team stealing thief mayor of Hartford goes into his primary, that he doesn't have a clear field. He doesn't have the entire baseball audience of Central Connecticut. I am retaining some of it with this team that I'm going to have here in New Britain." The timing of that, because I don't think she even knows the name of the franchise. It's going to be one of the 8 existing franchises, not an expansion.
But the naming is going to be great.
Right.
We're going to love the naming of the new New Britain team.
Exactly. But I'm sure it was, "Give me something I can say right now."
Okay. Well, let's continue a conversation that
we
started
dead bears.
That we started last week about a relatively new hat that Governor Malloy is wearing. Hillary Clinton's surrogate. He traveled to New Hampshire to stump for Clinton, whose popularity is not exactly on the upswing. I know, Paz, this is something you weren't around to talk about last week, but just put into focus a little bit for us this Malloy at home versus Malloy abroad persona. He was also in Canada this week talking with Eastern Canadian premiers about energy issues, sort of the Malloy on the road version versus the one we get back at home.
We all know the governor is stepping up his national profile, which is promising. Which is prompting all the speculation. What does he really want? I don't know that he has a grand plan. That if Hillary Clinton is elected, you know, he's already, you know, measured the drapes in one of the cabinet offices. But he clearly, I mean, he has said this over and over again. You know, he likes to be a player. And he got in early with Hillary. The only reason he didn't announce his endorsement earlier, it was the session was going on. But the first available moment, he came out and said, "Yeah, you know, I'm an old friend with the former governor of Maryland. But no, I'm going to be with Hillary." I went to New Hampshire for that visit. I was struck by two things. One, the palpable anxiety that – because the people who go to these meetings at this point, they're not shopping for a candidate. In New Hampshire, they want to see the candidate, the people who are shopping. For a surrogate like Dan Malloy, these are the people who have pretty much decided they're with Hillary and they want a pep talk. They want to feel good about what's going on. And these people were nervous as all hell, and it was all about the emails. So Malloy tried to reassure him on that. But the other thing that struck me is he wasn't well-versed in some other things. He was not in a position to go chapter and verse. You know, there was an obvious question about what Hillary would do to maintain Social Security, and the governor punted. I mean, he did it pretty gracefully. He promised he would get an answer and personally call the gentleman who asked the question. But I don't know. It struck me as he was not particularly well prepared to go on the road on behalf of Hillary Clinton.
And I just wonder if any of that plays in any unusual way back at home. I mean, there's always been criticism. There will always be criticism, Daniela, of any governor who goes out on behalf of a candidate, on behalf of the state to go get business, taking trips to Davos, Switzerland, or to Newfoundland. Someone will always criticize. Is there anything happening back at the Capitol in which people are saying, you know, Dan Malloy needs to be paying more attention back home and a little less attention to what's going on with Hillary Clinton?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's definitely the line. I mean, the Republicans have been calling this what, the subpoena avoidance tour or something. This, you know, Hillary and Malloy together, you know, both trying to skirt the rules. So, yeah, he's definitely vulnerable to that.
But it's one of the more, I think, specious tropes in politics, the idea that people cannot do more than one thing at a time. And, you know, like you hear that at the General Assembly. Why are they working on X when the budget is tanking? Well, because folks, trust me, there's 187 of them. They can do more than one thing. I don't know to what extent that's a concern of the governor, that he's going to be accused of being absentee.
Although I do think governors are sort of in a different category. I mean, very typically and very frequently, senators and reps from the Connecticut delegation in Washington will have these some frankly political leadership jobs at times, not just leadership jobs within Congress, but, you know, fundraising jobs and stuff like that. But they're sort of already not here, whereas governors are always sort of understood by the degree to which they're here and paying attention to things. Connecticut is possibly a little bit more fetishistic about this than most states. We know it's now a cliche that you can't be out of the state when there's a big weather emergency. You can't be skiing in Vermont or wherever Tom Mescal was. You can't be on St. Croix. You have to be right here. So governors, because of their sort of presumed stewardship role, I think they are judged by a slightly different yardstick.
And Malloy in particular, because he set himself up as Mr. Hands-on, I'm into everything and I know everything kind of, you know, role. And so, you know, anytime he seems to be sort of pulling back a little bit and going on vacation or doing whatever, you know, no one certainly would begrudge
the guy. He goes on vacation?
Well, no one would begrudge the guy a vacation, but, you know,
I mean. We used to beg him to go on vacation.
Just, you know, in his first term.
As well.
Yeah.
I think the very first time I talked to him, I wish there were more days in the year. I'd work more. I mean, he likes to work. I don't think he likes to go on vacation too much.
And so, you know, now that, you know, in his second term, you know, there's this sort of idea that maybe he's not quite as obsessive as he was the first 4 years, you know, and the Republicans are kind of jumping on that. So.
Look, from his first moments in office, he really contrasted his style with Jody Rell. Jody Rell and her staff seemed terrified at the idea that she would travel and she would be accused of going on anything approaching a junket, including the opportunity.
Including from Brookfield to Hartford. But anyway, go ahead.
including the opportunity as a new governor to meet the president of the United States. She did not attend a governor's meeting that winter where, quite frankly, she was going to be kind of the flavor of the month. Everybody was curious to see this woman who succeeded their buddy, John Rowland, who went down in flames. And she wouldn't go to Washington. She repeatedly wouldn't do that. Now, I think Malloy has gone way out on a limb and certainly inviting criticism with some of the trips. On the other hand, he clearly has cultivated great relationships with the Obama administration, and they've paid off for this state. I mean, they had a Hail Mary win on one of the Sandy grant programs where they got, you know, several hundred million dollars, I believe, or at least more than 100 million to repair one of those century-old bridges that was not closing properly. So, say what you will about Malloy, but he is not afraid to face criticism for building these relationships.
I'll just say quickly, for those who don't know, Bill Clinton has now announced that he's going to be coming to UConn in October to pick up a prize at the Dodd Center. UConn will not be paying for that trip for Bill Clinton to come and speak at UConn. As we talk in the wheelhouse here. Now, as Paz said earlier, Colin, the palpable anxiety felt on the campaign trail around the Clinton team, including Daniel Malloy, had a lot to do with the email scandal that is continuing to circle around Hillary Clinton. But, you know, there's some emails that I'm sure are going to be very controversial, and then there's some emails that are just amazing, and this is one.
Right. So I became obsessed yesterday with – and if you want to enjoy it on Twitter, all you have to do is just type in hashtag gefiltefish, and you'll see quite a bit of speculation. So there's an email in which the subject line is gefiltefish, and then the entire body of the email is Secretary Clinton saying, where are we on this? I wondered if it was maybe a code name for Dan Malloy or something. Maybe that's what they call him. But anyway, this is touched off. I mean, it's nice when politics squeezes out a little drop of enjoyment to us. And so this is has touched off all kinds of things. And a big think piece in the Washington Post about gefilte fish itself, what it is, why people either like it or don't like it. And so, yeah, let's enjoy a few of these emails even as they disturb us.
Spoiler alert, though. It ultimately is a really dry policy.
Yeah, it was a trade issue.
Yeah,
right?
It was a trade issue.
And that's the problem. Is it couldn't just be something fun. It couldn't be a code name for someone. My favorite actually quote from the Washington Post piece is someone in there says that everyone says it tastes like cat food, but that's why I like it, which I think is a great description of gefilte fish. Before we move too far from the absurd, you've spent time, Daniela, talking with people who are big supporters of Donald Trump in the state.
Yeah, there are a pocket of supporters. I don't know how big, or there's no polling, so we don't know really how significant this is. But there are some Republicans and independents, presumably Democrats as well, who like the guy.
How many of them are there? I mean, do we have a sense?
No, it's hard to say.
And what's the thing that they like? I mean, we get a better sense as we watch the 24-hour news channels, which are, of course, in our newsroom all the time, and everyone is obsessed with Donald Trump constantly. I think we get a sense of what America likes or doesn't like about the spectacle of Donald Trump. But what about Donald Trump, the candidate in Connecticut?
Yeah, and I think it's the same thing. I mean, I don't think it's not about ideology. It's not about his policy stances such as they are. It's about, you know, hey, he's a plain speaker. He's a, you know, he's going to tell it like it is. He doesn't bow to political correctness, you know, that kind of thing. And for better or worse, some people find that refreshing.
Paz?
He's gone from a joke to a very to a much watched gauge of how angry the electorate is. I mean, it's been amazing how fast this has shifted to, ha ha, he's going to burn himself out. He'll eventually say something outrageous. Eventually? You know, I mean, really, what are people waiting for? But so now you see, you know, some serious people in the Republican Party and on the Democratic side trying to say, OK, this seems to be edging into the area of a political phenomena. What does it mean? How does it reflect on our folks?
Mm. I mean, I think, first of all, I mean, there are people who support Donald Trump. There's a lot of them who are truly alarming people. And the New Yorker has a really terrific piece, I think, by Evan Osnos in this week's or last week's issues about this incredible coalition of people who really are white supremacists, you know, and really scary people who support Donald Trump. But I think Donald Trump's also kind of a placeholder for a lot of very vague discontent with the way things work, or more appropriately, don't work. And so, I mean, I think I mentioned last week there was a letter to The Current lamenting the fact that the online system for DMV doesn't work very well. And the guy ended his letter by saying, I wish Donald Trump were running for governor of Connecticut, because Donald Trump is so good at debugging computers and fixing things and stuff like that. Obviously, he's not. But just, you know, I mean, in the early 90s, radio was trying to figure out what to do with the vast wasteland that had become AM radio. I mean, there was nobody wanted it. Nobody had any use for it. This probably actually started in the late 80s. And there was this rise of the Rush Limbaugh-type conservative radio station. And why did that exist? Because there were just people sitting in their cars who were really angry. They were stuck in traffic jams. They were salesmen. They hadn't sold any widgets that day. They were furious. And they wanted a whole bunch of people to blame. They wanted someone to articulate their rage. And I see Donald Trump kind of in that category. I mean, he's sort of this little cauldron of rage that into which you can dump your own cup of boiling bile. And so I don't know that it's so much about any particular ideology that he holds, but he's just that thing. You know, he's the conduit for your anger about something that doesn't work.
Okay. We were going to break just now, but I just have to say, we just got a tweet here. And since we're talking about anger, Colin, you brought this up last week. I'll say this is basically a tweet. It says, are you not supposed to mention his name? Bernie Sanders is the reason why Hillary's declining in New Hampshire.
I can't believe you forgot.
You forgot one of the cardinal rules first of all, there's a few cardinal rules. You've got to mention Bernie Sanders or else people will be very upset with you. Of course, I've taken an oath as a news director here that I'm not allowed to talk about Bernie Sanders. You know, that's part of the overall media conspiracy to try to keep him down. This is what paths we've heard from people. We heard this about Ron Paul. We talked about this last week. People seem to have focused on the Bernie Sanders story on the fact that the media won't pay the guy any attention. And I don't know what else to make of that. I think NPR spent some time talking about him, but.
Well, then what I'm about to say will not please that person who tweeted.
Oh, boy. I mean,
Bernie Sanders strikes me, and this is an imperfect analogy, but you know, you wonder, is he the Gene McCarthy of this cycle? Is he the one who is pointing out?
Continue.
Well, I know. See, that's the problem. It's the next step. It ends up in a very bad place, and that's not where I want to go. But let's just leave it at that. Is Bernie the guy who is showing Hillary's weaknesses? So the question is, is there a young progressive who the left would get excited about? And I won't mention who stepped forward in 1968 because it casts a very dark shadow over that particular analogy. But you know what I'm saying. So far that person is 72-year-old Joe Biden, which does not seem to fit into the mood, you know, the mood that Trump has tapped into, and yes, that Bernie Sanders has tapped into. And so that's why it is the, you know, this is like if you're a weatherman looking at this map, you'd say, I don't know if it's going to rain tomorrow. It's just the signals are just all over the place.
Well, I think the serious point to be made of that, Colin, is almost everything that you could say about Donald Trump and people being angry about the way things are and why people might support him can be on the flip side imposed on Bernie Sanders. I mean, look, he has a lot of people who are supporting him because they're very angry about the way things are. It's in some ways mirror images.
Yeah, although the Sanders people are a little less incoherent.
Absolutely. I understand what you're saying.
I think Paz's analogy is actually pretty good. I mean, when you look at Bernie Sanders' support, which indubitably is growing, and his poll numbers are increasingly more impressive, you kind of have to parse it a little bit and say, well, how much of this is about Bernie Sanders and what he believes and who he is and all this kind of stuff, and how much of it is just dissatisfaction with Hillary Clinton? Hillary Clinton is just at the moment not running a very strong campaign, not dealing effectively with the issues that she needs to deal with. And there may be no really great way to deal with the email issue anyway. But if there is one, she hasn't found it.
I will just say for the record, I know a lot of people in the media. I know a lot of people in our business. And we're just not coordinated enough. We are far too scattered in our thinking to have any sort of a conspiracy about Bernie Sanders or Ron Paul or, frankly, anybody else. I think I can speak for most members of the media and say there's no conspiracy here. But thank you for continuing to tweet us at Where We Live. Let us know what you think about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and Dan Malloy. And tell us what you think about bears in Connecticut. That's what we'll be talking about next, as well as a brief interlude into the Bridgeport mayor's race that's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up in tomorrow's show, we'll be joined by the Department of Economic and Community Development Commissioner Catherine Smith. We'll tackle local business issues, including GE's threat to leave Connecticut. We'll look at the July jobs report. We'll consider how the Anthem-Cigna insurance merger could impact thousands of local employees. And we'll also ask her about the arts and tourism parts of her job. Spend the hour with Catherine Smith and also our business editor, Harry Jones, as we talk about some of these important issues tomorrow on Where We Live. Today is The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, is here, along with Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, and Daniela Altamari, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. We'll be turning to bears in Connecticut in just a moment, but we quickly wanted to turn to Bridgeport politics. Last week, Democratic candidates for mayor of Bridgeport met in a debate. One of the candidates, Mary Jane Foster, charged the administration of incumbent Mayor Bill Finch with a lack of transparency. This actually ended with an exchange between the moderator, our friend Connecticut Post reporter Ken Dixon, and Bill Finch.
The weekly news conference isn't going to cover a shooting that happened last night.
Let me do the best I can at answering three opponents now.
Oh, boy. There's Bill Finch getting into it with our buddy, the usually mild-mannered Ken Dixon. This was a – you've talked in person, Colin, to all of the Bridgeport mayoral candidates in this upcoming primary. And as much as we've spent time talking about Hartford today and maybe some of the back and forth in a nasty campaign, this one and that debate really turned into a circus.
Right. The hackles were up. The ears were laid back. Oh, wait a minute. That was the bear. all right. I was reading the wrong notes. I'm really sorry.
The teeth were shown.
The teeth were showing.
But Ganem has been tagged, though, twice. So.
That's oh, there's one point for Mark Bazniokas.
So, yeah, I mean, some of that is what you're hearing there is Bridgeport, right? You're hearing Bridgeport politics, and you're hearing, you know, it's a pretty unusual race. I mean, there are, first of all, it's worth noting, in the spirit of Bernie Sanders, there are actually three candidates. And Mary Jane Foster is actually a very interesting candidate and a very interesting presence. And what she'll do numerically to that race is kind of hard to predict. But the transparency issue has been a really big one, and it's one in which Finch seems kind of vulnerable. I mean, it's not just that there was this period of time in which it appeared that police reports would not be forthcoming to the press, except in a very, you know, carefully funneled way through the mayor's office. It's not just that. I mean, Bridgeport residents and part of this conversation, and it's coming as much from Foster as from Ganem, is that you can't get basic kinds of information even about how the grand list works and stuff like that. I don't know. Not being a Bridgeport reporter, I don't know how fair that is, but it's certainly been part of the conversation.
Just quickly, for those of us who maybe in the audience who don't know Ken, you know, for you get in a yelling match with Ken Dixon, I don't know. I mean, I he's a fairly laid back kind of guy. You know, you usually see Ken yelling. That's I think this is what happens with Bridgeport, right?
Well,
laid back. Ken Dixon's a friend of mine. Ken Dixon is one of the most kindest, most generous people on earth. But he periodically, while doing his job, gets a little edgy. And I was there that night, and I will admit, I was sitting there holding my breath, and I realized I was holding my breath when I thought, oh, this is not going well. And then I realized, oh, it's because you're holding your breath. Breathe. It was a profoundly uncomfortable moment.
A little bit uncomfortable, but you know, sometimes uncomfortable, it gets to some truths, Daniela. Sometimes these things can't all go smoothly, right?
Sure, that's politics. That's what makes it interesting.
That's what they call a moderator in Bridgeport.
Well, in Bridgeport, you know, the
we love Ken.
As a Hartford-based guy, I've dropped in and out of Bridgeport for various stories over the years, and I will admit that you know the very first time I went to a Bridgeport Democratic function. There was a fist fight that broke out between Mario Testa, who's now the Democratic town chairman, and a then 66-year-old guy named Mike Rizzitelli, who's no longer with us. So that was my introduction to Bridgeport politics. I used to think Hartford played hardball. Bridgeport is a whole nother thing.
Okay, so we're going to finish our program with one of the big stories of the week involving a bear. State wildlife officials are looking for a bear captured on video licking the leg of a hiker in Sessions Woods Wildlife Management Area in Burlington. DEP wildlife biologist Paul Rigo talked to Colin about what he saw in that video. Let's listen to Paul Rigo here.
In this case, the behavior that we saw on the video that was taken, we saw some aspects of true aggression by that bear. There was what we call jaw popping. At one point, the hackles were up, the ears were laid back. The fact that this bear, any time Stephanie turned her back, the bear approached. Mm-hmm. So the bear was definitely testing, and that was very, very concerning behavior.
And the Stephanie who's refers to as the hiker who took the video, who, of course, has now gotten threats because she posted the video of the bear. This has turned into actually a fairly large story in the state, Colin.
Yeah, and maybe even a little national bleed from it, too. It really is. I mean, I have to tell you how incredibly tired I am of people after communicating with them for the last two or three days about this. So So Stephanie Rifkin has been exposed to just incredible amounts of cyberbullying. I mean, it can be argued that her behavior in this situation was not the smartest behavior in the world, but there's also, you know, you're allowed to go walking in the woods without some kind of training permit, at least so far. And so, you know, maybe she didn't handle this whole thing right, just right. But, I mean, the other part of this is that, I mean, people don't understand this entire situation very well. The bear has had other incidents. There are debates going on Twitter this very moment about whether this bear was involved in trying to break into a house in Granby. The bear definitely pursued a woman to her office door in Windsor. The bear tried to get into Bradley Airport. airport to the landing strip. And so what you see is, what, you know, people going, well, you know, he's just – he was just being curious. Anyway, yeah, he was being curious about wine pairings. Okay. I think maybe Zinfandel would go really well with Stephanie. The truth is nobody really knows what the bear was doing. You know, these bears, they don't sign treaties saying, well, if you do this, then I'll do that. But if you're the DEEP and you're the people who are going to be held responsible the day this bear, if left alone, if allowed to roam the state, this bear who is clearly less afraid of people than most bears are, the day this bear mauls a child or kills somebody, it's going to come washing back up on you. So what somebody says on Twitter from Minnesota is it doesn't really have quite the same force as what the people say who really have to deal with the consequences of this if it's not handled right.
And let's be fair to the state wildlife biologists and those folks. They have, generally speaking, exerted a light hand on this stuff. You know, Chris Keating, who is a friend of Daniela's and mine, works at The Current. He had these amazing photos that he took from his house of at least two bears in his yard. You know, he called the cops and they just said, yeah, just don't poke the bear. And the same thing with Deep. I mean, there does not seem to be an overreaction to bears interacting with humans unless certain lines are crossed. The aspect to this we haven't touched on is social media. There's video. It's out there. Guess what, folks? The state of Connecticut quietly euthanizes a couple of bears every year because certain lines are crossed. These are bears that have been identified as troublesome bears, and then finally, you know, they're put down. There's not a peep. There's a video. There's cute video of this bear. And people, as Colin noted, I mean, people, you know, reacted to Stephanie kind of cooing to the bear at one point, saying, don't be scared, bear. And but be that as it may, the state has some what seemed to be, I'm not a wildlife scientist, seemed to have some reasonable standards for when they're going to put an animal down. They're not willy-nilly every time a bear stumbles into suburbia. They're not killing the bears.
Well, and of course, one of the reasons why bears are on a lot of people's minds is because, well, frankly, Daniela, they are stumbling into suburbia on a fairly regular basis. And it presents one of these tensions between the way we like to live in Connecticut and those things that live around us. Sometimes deer come into our backyards and they eat our flowers and we don't like it, and so we don't like deer as much as we used to. Sometimes bears come into our backyard and threaten our pets or our family, and we don't like them as much either.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a building problem or a building issue. I remember 6 or 7 years ago, the town of Simsbury actually sent home with the packet of stuff that the kids get home from school, you know, all the forms and everything. There was a sheet on what to do, you know, how to avoid bears, what to do if you encounter one. You know, this is for school kids. So it's definitely been an issue, and it's going to continue to become an issue more and more.
And although we should be clear, I mean, another thing I've been hearing, you can see I'm irritated, but –
well, you know, we're driving them out of their habitat.
Oh, no, we rebuilt their habitat. In 1850, there were zero bears in Connecticut. There were no bears here. Now, you can argue that we actually extirpated them prior to that, but as the state became a farming state, there just wasn't any place for bears to be.
There were no trees in Connecticut.
Right. As the state reforested, we really created a place that was a little bit more attractive to bears. And then as we started putting our garbage out, and then, of course, there are these soft-headed idiots who actually, you know, affirmatively feed the bears. But, I mean, right now they think they're at Pinkberry, you know, and they're just trying to figure out what topping to put on us. So, I mean, it's really not – I mean, what we've done is create a situation where bears are going to get closer and closer to us.
And you know, I've hiked in the Canadian Rockies, and I was struck by, you know, anytime you're in a village out there – the trash containers, they look like the night deposit at the bank, right?
Absolutely.
It's heavy armored thing. And, you know, maybe that's where we're going to have to go. But for the people who live in Western Connecticut, I think, you know, you got to think about where you have your trash out. I know you love to feed the birds, but, you know, bird feeders attract bears, folks.
Another edition of Bear Talk here on Where We Live. Mark Basniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut
Mirror. Hate mail, man.
Thanks so much, Paz. Thanks also to Daniela Altomare, Statehouse reporter for the Hartford Current. And thanks to Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR. The Wheelhouse, always produced by Tucker Ives, with help from Betsy Kaplan, Lydia Brown, Josh Nalea. Kyle Wolf's our technical producer. Heather Brandon's our digital editor. Katie Tolarski is the executive producer of Where We Live.